This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 48 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vaderhoff in Philly, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max.
Hi, David. Two episodes ago, we brought you our interview with Roger Connor from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. And as we were talking with him, if you'll recall, he mentioned another exhibitor at the show, Dr. Evan Ulrich. And he mentioned that this is a guy that we want to talk to.
Boy, was he right.
He was absolutely right.
And Roger actually ran over and dragged our guest over to our table. And we had a wonderful conversation about something that I don't think our video or photographs will do justice. But we talk about hexacopters, octocopters, quintocopters. But we actually got to see fly a monocopter.
That's right, a monocopter. You ask yourself, well, that means one. How does that work? And this is a small UAV of a type that we actually mentioned a long time ago. I think it might have been in episode 3, David. This is modeled after something like a maple seed, something that spins naturally as it, in the case of maple seeds, as they fall through the air. But this thing doesn't just fall. This thing maneuvers and in a way that's different from what you might expect with a multi-copter. It kind of flies in its own way, but it certainly does fly, doesn't it?
Yeah. Ironically, one of the security guards came by as we were getting a demonstration in the museum. And this little monocopter was getting awfully close to their Republic P-47 Thunderbolt from World War II. Luckily, nothing happened, but the guard was a bit disgruntled at our guest. And our guest's name is?
It's Dr. Evan Ulrich. And you're going to hear our conversation with him in just a second here. And we want to thank him for taking the time to see us. And he's going to talk about how he developed the concept. He's going to talk about some of the iterations he went through, how these things are actually controlled. Now, I will make one suggestion. My recommendation is before you listen to our conversation with Dr. Ulrich, put us on pause, go over to the show notes and take a look at the picture, or go to the webpage that has pictures and videos of this and take a look at it. It's roboseedmav.com. Because I think if you see this first, as you're listening to our conversation with Dr. Ulrich, you'll get a better appreciation for the description that he's giving you of the actual craft here.
The other part about it is Dr. Ulrich couldn't be more than 27 in youthful exuberance. And, it's not often that people make me feel old, but this is just awesome. This was just fun technology, and it's just cool. So, yeah, definitely look at the show notes. You definitely have to watch it fly. And I guess on that, we will see you on the flip side. So here's Dr. Ulrich with us at Pilot Day.
Well, again, it's Max and David still at the Udvar-Hazy Center for the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum Be a Pilot Day. And we have run across someone here, very interesting, Evan Ulrich. Dr. Evan Ulrich, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Thanks, great to be here.
Now, we actually had talked in a previous episode, David, about this little device that Evan has created.
It's cool. We talk about multicopters and hexacopters and octocopters and quad rotors. And, well, what am I looking at?
Well, it's a monocopter. It turns out you actually only need one wing to fly.
And how does that work? I mean, what's the physics of this? Well, let's describe it first. This thing is about, what, 8 or 10 inches maybe?
Yeah, and it's kind of like a banana with a wing attached to it.
With a single wing.
Wing attached to it.
And single rotor.
Single rotor. And the place of a tail boom that you would find on a typical helicopter, you find a propeller again, only instead of keeping the orientation fixed and basically not rotating, the propeller on this vehicle spins it. So instead of preventing rotation, it causes rotation.
It causes rotation. And so this sort of spins like a maple seed might?
Exactly like a maple seed.
Was that the inspiration?
Yeah, it was, actually. So the research for this began back in 2006 under the direction of now Dean Daryl Pines at University of Maryland. And the problem that we were interested in studying was basically the natural flight of maple seeds. So we sort of ran into this problem where you're trying to scale down traditional configurations of helicopters. Mm. And helicopters by nature are very complicated.
Sure.
And as you reduce their size, their complexity remains the same, but their aerodynamic efficiency goes away.
Yeah.
So they sort of become infeasible at a certain scale. So we said, okay, what's the most simple rotating thing, you know, that flies? Or really, what's the most simple thing, example in nature that flies? And a maple seed or a sycamore seed or a samara, which is the term for a winged seed.
Okay.
Is it. There's no moving parts.
Right.
And every time you drop them, they'll auto-rotate. You can break them in half, they'll still auto-rotate. They're very robust.
Yeah, I have years of throwing up maple seed, you know. True av geeks grab a hold of them, throw them all up in the air, and just go, ooh, and ah, as they go flying back down.
Yeah, I think that's actually a universal human experience. I did the exact same thing.
So did you have to go through a lot of iterations of the design?
Yeah, many iterations.
Or are you still iterating?
It is still it's still improving all the time. So what we did was to take natural maple seeds, and we emulated their design and scaled it up and created a bunch of them using a rapid prototyping machine. So I was able to design a number of different types of these auto-rotating maple seed configurations, and we studied it very precisely with some high-speed cameras. And we found that when they fall, they do it in one of two ways. They either go straight down or they take this helical path down, carving out sort of a large circle as they fall. Now, the difference between those flight paths was actually just the wing pitch relative to the ground. So, you know, you can see the wing, how it's oriented relative to the ground actually controls how tight a circle it falls in. So starting with that understanding and an understanding of where the wing area should be relative to the vehicle, which you'll notice is more like a maple seed than a helicopter. Helicopters have a thick root, and they get slender as they go towards the tip. This is the opposite.
Just the opposite. It gets it has a thin root, and it gets wider.
It's kind of like a paddle blade propeller.
Yes. Exactly.
Now, this looks like it's constructed out of carbon fiber.
Yeah, that's true. And they were initially made out of plastic, but we had a small laboratory, and, you know, I'm trying to do science, and science needs to be repeatable. Well, a one-off prototype vehicle, once destroyed, can never be built again.
Yes.
So about 100 iterations later, every plastic part just about had been replaced by carbon fiber or reinforced with Kevlar. Mm-hmm. Now we've got a vehicle that is nearly indestructible and can run into just about anything and maintain its form and function.
And evidently is bulletproof if it's Kevlar.
Exactly. So one of the nice things about this design is that the wing's very flexible. It's not flexible at the root. It's very rigid. Mm. But so if you're going to run into something, this wing will deflect. And it'll actually push it away from a wall. And it won't transfer the load
to the body.
Servo. Yeah.
And so the propulsion, just a standard electric motor? That you would usually find on a quadcopter or something?
Yeah, I would say so. It's a bit... You know, so basically motors at this scale are kind of, there's an optimum propeller for it. So matching the propeller to the motor was really pretty essential, and this is actually a modified three-bladed carbon fiber propeller, so from Denmark, nonetheless.
Wow.
And the motors are from overseas also. And the pair of these actually is able to produce 120 grams of thrust. Well, and when you go to purchase them, they'll claim that they can only produce 40 grams of thrust. So there's been some modifications to enhance that. But at a very basic level, it's the same motor that you would find on a quadcopter. So you can pull it off. You can see the little wire wrappings in there and little neodymium magnets.
Right.
And I've got a little light, an LED there that's battery-powered, obviously. And this helps me with navigation and seeing it because... Actually, the whole vehicle is rotating, so when you're observing it in flight from the ground, all you really see is a black disc at the center of rotation. You don't observe the wing as it's moving too quickly. So when you put a little light on there, you get basically a blue circle that looks like it's a frisbee that's flying around.
So what orientation is it when in flight?
So it's spinning about this axis here. So it's basically the center of the vehicle, and it rotates like this. So you have the propeller, which is spinning, producing a force, not only in the horizontal direction to spin the vehicle, but also in the vertical direction to provide some lift and stability.
Because the motor is mounted at an angle.
Yeah,
it's
canted.
It's canted.
And that was something that was an addition that... There are a number of different configurations that work, but this is optimal.
Right.
And the bend of the airframe that you observe here, sort of making it shaped like a banana, is no accident either. And it allows for when you have a gust that would make a typical helicopter go unstable at this scale, the reaction is for the vehicle to tip. Well, you've got this force that's opposed to it on the opposite side of the center of mass, so it balances it out.
I see.
So it makes it extremely stable, and actually in any a level of gusty flight, it doesn't go unstable. That may be uncontrollable, but it's not going to go unstable.
Right.
It's already spinning. It should be spinning out of control at that point.
Well, speaking of control,
yes.
What challenges do you face, or are there some complications as a result of this design?
Absolutely. So, and that was part of my graduate studies research was actually in control theory, and so... What you end up having with this airframe is no stationary point of reference.
Ah, yes.
So typically when you want to go from point A to point B, you need to know where you're pointing so you can go where to go next. This vehicle has some orientation ambiguity, to put it gently. And so the way that we navigate without any onboard electronics that allow us to sense this direction is basically by tracking the center of mass. So the whole vehicle, in addition to spinning, is processing in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
And the size of that circle is what I can control. I mentioned earlier that maple seeds naturally fly in circles of varying radius. You can modify the radius by modifying the wing pitch. So there's only two control inputs for this vehicle. You have the throttle, and you have the wing pitch here.
Yes.
And so it's actually much simpler control scheme than what you would find on a traditional helicopter or fixed-wing aircraft. And so the inputs that I give it while flying are very slow, and it's really only a single input after I set it to trim. So I set the throttle at a trim, and then I can navigate around by just moving the wing there.
Fascinating.
And it can one of the advantages of being balanced in the same way as a maple seed is that from any altitude, you can have an engine out, and you can auto-rotate to the ground and safely recover the vehicle.
Brilliant.
So several miles up, it doesn't matter. You're going to auto-rotate. You're not going to hurt anything on the ground, and the vehicle will be safe as well.
Wow.
So it's got a number of advantages despite its complicated aerodynamics and control paradigm.
So what's next? Where do you go with this next?
So there's a number of directions that I personally would like to go. It's obvious that there's some appeal as a hobby aircraft or a toy. But beyond that, I think it has some important contributions to make in the realm of climate studying. So you have these large-scale weather systems.
That's why. That's when we brought this up, about dropping them out into hurricanes.
Yes.
So we've talked about this, and I'm kept thinking, it's weather, but I can't remember. But now that I remember it, reading about it, it was talking about dropping them out of, like, C-130s flying into hurricanes so you could get more intense weather lower sensors lower into the hurricane, correct?
Absolutely. That's great minds think alike. So I guess to back up a little, the paradigm that we currently have for studying hurricanes is you have a C-130 fly over with the crew, you drop a buoy that has a parachute on it, and it falls through the hurricane. You take data all the while. It hits the water, broadcasts whatever data it's collected, and you're done. Now a vehicle like this, you could have much more, you know, persistent surveillance. And it remains to be seen, but I postulate that in a hurricane, this vehicle could remain aloft without much power consumption because of its ability to auto-rotate like a maple seed. You may be able to turn it off and have it just fly with, you know, the 100-plus mile-an-hour winds that are, you know, in the rotational vortices of the hurricane. So you may be able to instrument a hurricane with a number of these, and it might just carry them along with you.
Wow, fantastic.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might have issues with things running into it, but it's such a small vehicle that, you know, if you distribute them...
Well, on size, is it scalable? Can you create larger versions of the same thing?
Absolutely.
For greater payload?
Absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, the problem that we were tackling... In my graduate studies was to shrink down the model. So
right.
I believe it was in 1952, a fellow by the name of McCutcheon, Dr. McCutcheon, was the first person to invent the monocopter. And it was a gas-powered vehicle, had a 3-foot wingspan, and it was a bit of a different configuration with the motor on the opposite side of the wing. Now, it wasn't terribly stable, but it did fly. The aerodynamics were more favorable than they are with this vehicle, and he was able to actually use what would be considered an airplane wing design. So thick at the root, thin at the tip. So the smallest one that we've built with the design configuration change is actually the size of a maple seed. So we've got them, the wing is 7.5 centimeters long.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a 9.5 gram vehicle, and we get about 5 minutes of flight out of it. It's tiny.
Yes.
Very tiny.
Yes.
But it's only controllable up and down. So there's, you know, some disadvantages too. But scaling up, I've made up to an 18-inch wingspan, wherein I was able to get 25 minutes of flight time with a 10-gram payload. So it scales up very nicely. There's this thing in aerodynamics known as Reynolds number. And Reynolds number gives you, it's basically how sticky the air is. And when you get down to insect level, the air is very sticky. And the way that the wind behaves is different than it does on an airplane. A typical airplane has a lift to drag ratio of maybe 100 or 200 at best. The lift to drag ratio of this vehicle's wing is 10. So you have substantial disadvantages when it comes to the aerodynamics at this scale. So making it bigger is absolutely better. And everything scales up on this vehicle magnificently.
Wow.
Scaling down was the issue.
Yes.
Up, we can make... I believe that the end game for this, maybe beyond, you know, my lifetime and capabilities, would be to have this be basically a low-altitude satellite that exists in the jet stream. So you have some of these auto-rotating in the jet stream, providing the same capabilities that satellites do today, only instead of when your satellite malfunctions, you leave it up there or deorbits and you lose it, this thing could auto-rotate down and you could service it. And then you can send it back up. So, and, you know, all the while being powered by the jet stream.
Right. Well, this is brilliant. And this is some really fascinating stuff. This is another example, David, of the interesting kinds of work that's happening in this space these days.
Yeah, we're amazed and fascinated by the creativity of UAVs right now. And what was it? A game-changing technology? No, a disruptive technology.
A disruptive technology. Yes.
And this is just cool.
It's another example.
It's just another really cool example. And I'll be honest, folks, it doesn't look like it would fly.
No, it really doesn't. It really does.
Looks like a broken airplane, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
Like, where's the other wing?
Right,
where's the rest of it? That's why we'll have pictures on the website, because this is one of those things that I don't think audio will do it justice.
No, but it's, to see this.
It's,
so, in fact, in that vein, Evan, you have there's a website where people can go learn more, see more about this, right? RoboSeedMAV.com.
That's the one.
And also RoboSeed on YouTube.
Yes.
Where there are probably lots of videos that that folks can see. Is this work associated that you're doing with a particular university?
Yes, actually. So this work was done at University of Maryland in College Park. Mm. They've got one of the best rotorcraft centers in the world. And so I was very lucky to have been given the opportunity to solve this problem, although initially it was a bit of a nightmare. Controlling a maple seed seems kind of out there.
Yeah.
Made me wonder how a professor is ever able to scope, what a graduate student's supposed to study. But 6 years later patent, and we've got a vehicle. So it's
fantastic.
We had a great team there, and I have to say that definitely could not have done it, without my advisor, Daryl Pines, and sort of co-advisor, Sean Humbert. They've definitely been key players in this. So.
Very good.
And you'll come back with more when you have more news?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're planning to tackle some world records coming up pretty shortly here. That the category for things under a kilogram is wide open. So
you're going to
might
go
be
for
setting
that,
it by flying up 100 feet today.
Yes.
No observers. So.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time and coming on, and definitely keep us in the loop, because this is fascinating technology, and we definitely want to be part of it. And any way we can promote your organization, and just come back and go after those world records. That'll be really cool.
Yes.
Great. Thanks. Well, thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Well, I'll tell you, David, we kind of stumbled into our interview with him, our conversation with him, and I'm so glad we did, because not only was it fascinating to meet him, but also to listen to his description of this this little thing and actually get to see it in flight. He did mention that he was the only person allowed to do any flight inside the museum. There were people doing some things outside, but I guess the Smithsonian had enough faith in what he had done that they actually allowed him to demonstrate this thing inside the museum.
Yeah, and this is another example of how lucky we are to have a relationship with the museum. And again, we'd like to thank Roger for bringing him over and introducing us, because it's this kind of technology that just blows our minds, and we just get so excited about it, and we don't want to admit it, but we'll admit it out loud that our two interviews that we got for you guys were probably the best interviews of the whole weekend.
Don't let Rob hear you say that.
But it was really, really cool. And like I said, and hopefully we can have Dr. Ulrich back. We want to follow his progress. If you were like me as a little kid, they were fascinating when they would fall from the trees. You'd pick up a handful, throw them up in the sky, and you just sort of watch them whirligig down. And that's what this did, except it could go up and down by itself.
So as David mentioned, you can find more about this in the show notes. This has been episode 48.
You can find links to the show notes at theuavdigest.com/48.
And you can also learn more at Dr. Ulrich's website. That's RoboSeedMAV.com. And he's also on YouTube as RoboSeed. So I invite you to find more there. Now, David, where can folks find more about us? Where can they follow us along?
They can follow us on Twitter, which is at UAV Digest. They can follow us on Facebook, which is facebook.com/UAV Digest. Don't forget iTunes. Don't forget, if you love us, leave us a feedback. And of course, you can always email us at feedback@theuavdigest.com. And upcoming, we're going to have a lot more interviews. We've got some things starting to line up about fire and agribusiness. So we're going to have more interviews like this, and maybe we'll scatter them through. But of course, next episode, I'm sure we'll return back to our one true love, the news.
Yeah, there's never a limit to what we can talk about, what we'd like to talk about on this show. So we're going to keep doing that. So we want to thank you all for listening. And this has been Max in Hartford.
Dave in Philly. Thanks for listening.